Hi, this is Marianne Williamson. I first met Wayne Dyer when we traveled with Louise Hay to Australia in, I believe, 1995 to give a series of lectures there. At first, I was kind of intimidated because I had been reading his books for so many years, but I soon found that he was one of the friendliest as well as most profound people that I had ever met. He is extremely warm and kind, and he is also a very loyal friend. I think the reason his work is so important is because we all began reading him at a time when there was more emphasis on the psychological than on the spiritual. And today, he is one of the few people that makes it so clear we don't have to choose between the two. He himself has made a progression in which he has gone from the more specifically psychological self-help orientation to the deeply spiritual, metaphysical worldview based on the deeper religious and philosophical wisdoms of the world. So I think he's brought millions of people along with him. And when I think of this whole field of endeavor, I think that he's one of the brightest lights, and we're extremely lucky to have him among us.
Volume 7, Living from Your Highest Self.
It seems to me that there are two categories, or a way of categorizing ourselves into two different ways of how we view the world. There are people who are what I call multisensory beings, and there are people who we call five-sensory beings. Another way, another term that I use in real magic is there are spiritual beings and there are non-spiritual beings. The problem with that designation is that a person who is a non-spiritual being, this doesn't indicate that they are not religious, that they're not moral, that they're not good people. And it's not a designation between good and bad, moral and immoral, right and wrong. It's just some people, as they go along in their life, have a way of assessing what their world is like, and other people do it in quite different ways. And to make that distinction, in order to be able to create real magic, it is my contention that you will have to make the shift from being a five-sensory, or what I call a non-spiritual being, to becoming a multi-sensory being. And it is my very strong impression from all that I have read and all the people that I have been around who are able to manifest miracles for themselves, that in order to get to that place of real magic, where miracles become not only something that happened to you, but that you manifest and create for yourself, that you'll need to really be working on getting yourself aligned in this new spiritual way, rather than in the five, limited to the five senses. A non-spiritual being is limited to the five senses in their beliefs and in their thoughts. And very briefly, the five-sensory being sees the world in terms of, I'll only believe it when I see it, rather than the other way around. If I can't see it, if I can't touch it, if I can't taste it, if I can't feel it, I then know that it doesn't exist. And this is the real practical-oriented individual, the person who is, quote, left brain, very scientific in their approach, and doesn't have a whole lot of room in their consciousness for things that they can't get a hold of. The spiritual being, the multisensory being, is someone who knows that the five senses are just little tools that we have, and that our body is nothing more than a package that contains our soul, and that the invisible part of us, our intuition, our thoughts, our feelings, are very real, and it isn't just something to read about in holy books or on Sunday mornings, but that this invisible part of our humanity is in fact the very essence of our humanity.
You see,
It's like there's a gate. And on the other side of the gate, once you go through the gate, there's a light. And when you get through there, when you get into and past all of the stuff that you've been living in your life, you go through the gate, the most amazing things begin to happen. You begin to develop a whole different approach to what you're about and how you're living and what this life is and why you're here and what it's all about. It becomes really crystal clear. And some of the symptoms of going through the gate are that you develop this incredible compassion for others and for yourself, and an acceptance of that I am more than this form. I have to be. And what I am that is beyond this form is much more divine than the form itself, which will wear out. You begin to see that everything vibrates. All form or matter down here is vibrating. It looks solid, but nothing is. I mean, this piece of chalk is not solid. It looks like it is because it's vibrating at the speed of light or close to it, so it looks very much like that. And then you begin to see that about everything, that everything is just vibrating at a different... And then you got to understand that so are you. You are too. If you get examined under a real strong microscope, you'll find that you're constantly in motion. You're not formed. You're not solid. You just can't see it because your eye is only capable of perceiving a certain level of vibration, certain colors, the color scheme and all of that. But you know you're more than that. You begin to see that as things vibrate faster and faster and faster, that sound, something you can't see, but you know it's out there. And so I talk and you hear, and you know that there are waves in the air, aren't they? And that they hit your eardrum at a certain level. And you know that, and you can see it with certain kinds of technological equipment. You can see that they're in the air. Even though you can't get them, they're there. I mean, I'm saying, I even have a microphone. I'm saying things, and something's coming out of my mouth, and you're picking it up someplace, but it's not visible, is it? You see that you go up a little further, and you get into what we call electrum, the stuff of the earth, like the north and the south pole, and this electricity. If you only believe in what you see, then why do you pay your electric bill? I mean, think about it. You plug something in, this thing starts going, stick your finger in there. You know there's something in there. There's something going on. And you look at the earth and you see it's all charged, and so are you. You are. I mean, you're this electrical circuitry that is constantly being charged at all different levels. That's part of what you are, in addition to all of this pile of stuff over here. And then you go up a little further and you get to light. This green board looks green, not because it's green, but because light is vibrating at a certain speed. And it vibrates to the speed that we call green. And we just agree that it's green. And we agree that something vibrates that dress you're wearing is red, we'll call that red. And if it vibrates so fast that you can't see, we'll call that white. And if it vibrates a little slower, 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 we call it good, then it's black. And that's just all vibration. There's no blue in the universe. There's only our agreement. All these things are vibrating, 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 different levels. And then what do you think? Speculate on something else. That up here, that the fastest vibratory motion in the universe is thought. I am hypothesizing and suggesting to you that you are thought. And that is the stuff of the universe, and you can never kill it. It's the fastest vibratory pattern in the world, and you can't kill thought. And nothing gets formed, and nothing dies. Everything is in transition. All of this stuff is in transition. Matter is in transition. Now, you want to really get spooked out. Every 7 years, every cell in your body changes. There's not one cell in your body today that was there 7 years ago. Not one. Not one bit of the form that you were in 7 years ago is here today. None of it. It's all different. And yet you can remember being there 7 years ago. How do you account for that? So it's not a question of whether you occupy different bodies or not. We all occupy many, many different bodies all the time. And the key to understanding this is that none of us are ever formed. None of us are ever formed. And we are something beyond the form that we live and breathe each day. So when you look in the mirror and you see funny things happening to your form, strange things are happening to my form, I don't get it. I got hairs falling out in one place where they used to be, and I got them growing in other places. I mean, whoever had ear hairs? I never had a... What is that?
I get my hair cut, and the guy goes in, he takes a little thing, and it goes into my ear and cuts, you know. I never had any hairs there. Nose hairs. What are those doing? Huh? A few more facial hairs and a little more coarse than they used to be. A lot of strange things happening to my form.
A few years ago, in 1978 or 79, I was invited to a place called Los Gatos. I was going to do a workshop, a weekend workshop, and they have a place there called Getting in Touch. I said yes, it sounded like a nice thing, and at that time I was saying yes to everything. If anybody wanted me to speak, four rats in a sewer said, look, will you come and speak? All right, I can do it, all right? And I would show up. We agreed that I would come on a Friday and I would speak Friday night, and then I would speak Saturday, and it would be in a small sort of intimate setting, right? We would sit around in couches and people would pay a tuition, and it was like a little mini course. I arrived at this place. I flew into San Francisco, and then I rented a car, and it was way back in amongst all the redwoods, and it was very, very difficult to find. So I showed up Friday night to give my talk, and I went there, and it was going to be sort of informal, and that was fine with me. So I look out, and about a third of my audience doesn't have any clothes on. Nothing. I mean, it's clothing optional, and I didn't see that in the... I thought, well, they must have misinterpreted, and it's not erroneous zones that they want me to talk about at all. You know. So I realized that this place, Getting in Touch, was a clothing optional. They were teaching people to be masseuses and masseurs and so on. I looked at it, and it was all right. And so we talked, and as soon as I told him to put on some clothes and not to be so disgusting, no, I didn't do that. But anyway, at this particular place, they had a whole lot of hot tubs. And I mean a lot of them. They had maybe 15, 18. And the hot tubs all had different temperatures in the water. They ranged from, I think, 116 or something like that degrees Fahrenheit to like 45 degrees. And as the people were talking, I noticed that they were saying which of the hot tubs they were going to go into. Almost everybody, and when I say that, I mean 298 or 299 out of 300, were going to operate this weekend in these hot tubs from this range of what you might call a comfort zone. I'm not going in any of the hot stuff, and I'm not going in any of the cold stuff. And I'll sort of experience the tubs between 90 and 96, or whatever it was. And all of this experience over here of experiencing the hotter temperatures, and all of the experiences over here of the lower temperatures were going to be ignored by all of the people in favor of staying right with what I know and am comfortable with and can enjoy, and that's it. And that's the level that I am going to only experience my life. Now, that metaphor is applicable to almost all of us all the time. We are only willing to experience that which we know, where we're safe, and not go outside of those limits. And what I would ask of you is to open yourself up to not being that kind of person any longer, who will only experience and go with what you know the outcome to be already and know that you can be comfortable with. And also know that within each one of us, we have this phenomenal capacity to be able to experience this entire range of human experience and to do it in comfort without suffering. And all it takes is getting out of that 1% of living your life through form, through your body, through the package, and not seeing each other just as packages, but knowing inside there's something much grander than all of this. Every night when you go off to sleep, you enter into what we call the dream state or the dream consciousness. And when you enter into dream consciousness, you leave behind this physical world and all of its limitations, and you enter into this world of pure consciousness, and you enter with no doubt. And as you enter into this world without any doubt, you open up a whole world of possibilities. Now just imagine yourself in your dream. And in the dream, you want to examine something in a room. Let's say you find yourself in a kitchen, and you're sitting at a kitchen table in your dream. And as you're sitting there talking to whomever in your dream, you notice that on a shelf, oh, about 10 feet away on the other side of the kitchen, there's a bouquet of flowers. And you want to examine those flowers and just look at them more closely to see what the petals look like and what the colors look like. And you want to have a real close sort of examination of them. Now, in waking consciousness, if that were to happen to you, you would have to get up, walk over to the flowers, and examine the flowers. And you'd say, oh, I see, these leaves look like this. And, oh, yeah, here's the stems over here. And, oh, there's little yellow pieces in the middle. And, oh, isn't that an interesting thing? And you'd be able to examine them more closely. But in your dream state, we have something that is called intention. And with intention, you don't have to get up and walk over to them. You just have the intention that you would like to examine them. And how do you get to examine those flowers in your dream state? You bring them to you rather than you going to them. So for one third of your life, you have an absence of doubt. With that absence of doubt, you have the ability to have an intention to do something, and then you bring it to you. Here's the sound that goes with that. You go, whoosh, and there they are. The flowers are right in front of your face, and you can look at them, and you didn't have to move. And then when you want them gone, you go, whoosh. What I would like to say to you is if you could enter waking consciousness with the same absence of doubt that you have when you enter dream consciousness, that you might have the possibility, just might, I'm just throwing it out at you, that you might have the possibility to bring to you those things that you would like to have without your having to get up and go to them or move around. The way to understand this, it seems to me, is to understand the difference between what you know and what you believe. A belief is something that has certain characteristics. A knowing has certain characteristics. I've identified 5 characteristics that differentiate a belief from a knowing. Beliefs are handed to you. Knowings come from within, which means that a belief has doubt attached to it. A knowing has no doubt because it comes from within, from your direct experience. The second characteristic that distinguishes a belief from a knowing. Beliefs will let you down in a crisis. Knowings never let you down. The reason that a belief is something that you cannot rely upon in a crisis is because of the doubt that is attached to it. And so it isn't reliable. Whereas what you know, anything that you absolutely know, for example, how to ride a bicycle or how to swim or any of those things, when a crisis comes along, you will not be let down. A third characteristic that distinguishes beliefs from knowings is that your beliefs are mental exercises, your knowings are physical exercises. Your beliefs are located in the mental realm as thoughts that you constantly reinforce. These are strictly mental exercises that you constantly practice until they become your reality. That is, a reality based upon the doubt that is attached to these beliefs. You may believe that people shouldn't wear jewelry in their nose, or that people are evil who don't attend church. These kinds of beliefs will influence your conduct and cause you to judge others until you change your belief and perhaps search out a nose piercer. Your knowings are located in the physical domain, even though they originated in the mental. When you know something, it is a part of your total being, originating in the mental and residing in your complete being. That which you absolutely know with certainty, such as how to dance the mambo or ice skate or swim or make love or ride a bicycle, is a part of your cellular being. It resides so deeply within you that it is in the cells of your humanity. That which you once only believed because it was given to you by some external person, has now been transformed into a knowing. The fourth distinction between a belief and a knowing is that a belief will restrict you while a knowing will empower you. The reason a belief restricts you is that there is doubt attached to it, and therefore, when you go to act upon it, you do sort of tenuously, just with a little bit of reservation, and so there's a restriction, whereas a knowing something that you absolutely know that you can rely upon, will empower you. It's the difference between knowing about God and knowing God. Knowing about God is a belief. Knowing God is a knowing. And knowing about God usually means that you have some reservations. I'm not quite sure about all of this higher power stuff, and I'm not quite sure about whether there really is a higher self. Whereas when you've learned to experience it, and that's what these keys to higher awareness are designed to do, then you absolutely know God, not just know about it. The fifth and final characteristic that distinguishes a belief from a knowing is that your beliefs are all transitory, while your knowings are eternal. Just think about some of the beliefs that you have today and how they've shifted over the years. Remember how many people were shocked to see men wearing long hair and earrings? I can remember working in a high school back in the inner city of Detroit, and a young man came in with his hair real long and with earrings on, and they expelled him from the school and told him to go home and get a haircut and to stop dressing like a sissy. Today, the very same people who suspended him are wearing those same kinds of jewelry and have their hair quite a bit longer than they did in those days. And now you watch on Sunday afternoons in the National Football League, and you see these big, burly mastodons of masculinity with their long hair and their earrings in the interviews or protruding from their helmets. So our beliefs about things are very transitory, and they're shifting all the time. But what you know is there with you forever.
One of the most alarming insights I had was 5 years ago when my grandmother died. I was with her. She was 95 years old in 1984. And she was an hour from death. And she was admitted to the hospital about 2 o'clock in the morning. And one of the things that the hospital did was that they weighed her for some reason. They had to have, you know, they're into their records and keeping track of things. You don't get into heaven if you don't have a weight certificate. And maybe if you excess baggage, you don't get in or something. I don't know what their thinking is. But there's this kind of linear, all this record keeping. I always wonder about all the people who died before we had records, before we did that. You know, whatever happened to all of them? And so she weighed 133 pounds when she entered the hospital. And we all knew that she was very close. And then life passed from her body. I mean, we watched as life literally left her body. And there she was. There was this package of, it was getting cold and stiff, and it was like this package of bones and stuff, matter. And it certainly wasn't my grandmother, that package there that was now deteriorating and going to be gone. And when they weighed her for the death certificate, she weighed 133 pounds. Exactly the same. So that whatever it is that constituted her life, her very life, her very essence, is invisible and weightless. You can't weigh it. And that's true for you. That's true for every single one of us. That what our life really is all about, it defies the world of form. It defies the world of linear. And yet we spend almost all of our energy and our time here, in this part of our consciousness, in form, believing that this is who we are. You know, John Quincy Adams sat in the White House. He was our sixth president, and he was the most spiritual man who ever sat there, I think. He was a man who rejected slavery while other people, including one of his best friends, Thomas Jefferson, practiced it. He was a man who was highly spiritual and very intellectual, perhaps the highest intellect of anyone who ever was there. And this is what he wrote about himself 3 days before he died in a letter to Thomas Jefferson. He used his house as a metaphor for his body. He said, "John Quincy Adams is well, but the house in which he lives at the present time is becoming dilapidated. It's tottering on its foundations. Time and the seasons have nearly destroyed it. Its roof is pretty well worn out." I can identify with that one, I'll tell you. "Its walls are much shattered and tremble with every wind. I think John Quincy Adams will have to move out of it soon. But he himself is quite well, thank you." That concept of understanding that universal intelligence that is a part of our consciousness is not just something for mystics and people to go in loincloths and contemplate in caves. It's for us. It's for every one of us in the practice of our daily lives, in whatever business we're in.
There was a book written by Dan Millman called The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. And he was told, as he was learning how to have this higher consciousness by his teacher, whose name was Socrates, to go out on a rock and sit there until he could come in and have something important to say. And he went out and he sat for like 6 hours, and everything he thought of, he thought, well, that's not important, and no, that's really not important. And he starts looking at your mind and thinking about all the things that it thinks about and gets preoccupied with, and hardly anything matters. We get into our little drama of our little life and whether it's going to rain or whether we're going to make enough money and all, and you start thinking, but does that matter? He would go out and he would say something to Socrates, and Socrates said, no, that's not important. And he'd go back out there and he'd sit for another 6 hours and he'd meditate. And he finally came in after like 24 hours and he said, there are no ordinary moments. And Socrates said, yes, that matters. That's an important, intelligent thing to think, to understand. That every moment in your life is a miracle. And that everything that you're going through in your life, you can stand back and just watch yourself go through it. You can observe yourself go through it. And after doing that for a while, and you begin to say, this isn't really me. This isn't really me. I'm getting up in the morning now, and I'm getting on the freeway, and I'm going, but this isn't really what I am. I'm this consciousness that's behind all of this. And after a while, that consciousness is no longer something that you see yourself as separated from. You see that as what you are. And then you start changing. You start having dramatic new changes in your life. And that old consciousness is no longer there, that old consciousness of accumulation and having to get things done. And then you become much more peaceful with it all. And then you begin to realize after a while that everything that I'm doing is all right. It's fine. Even when I mess it up and even when the deal doesn't go through, that there's something to learn. There's an opportunity in that obstacle or in that failure. You get this incredible internal peace with all the things that you're doing and all the roles that you're playing. And yet you know that you're going through all of these roles, and it's like the only way you ever know when you're dreaming is to awaken. I mean, just think about it. If you'd never woke up, you would never know you were dreaming. That's true at this level of consciousness, too. The only way to see that this is all an illusion, that you are destroying yourself with things that aren't even real, you know, like whether this person likes me or doesn't, or whether I get that money or whether I don't, and all that, that's stuff that you can't do anything with anyway, you begin to say that, well, if I'm going to mess myself up, I'm not going to mess myself up with illusions, with things that don't matter. So I just think I'll stop messing myself up completely. I won't even think like that any longer. And before long, instead of being disharmony and full of anger and upsettedness and hatred and all of that, you become filled with acceptance, a new kind of love, a new kind of approach to all of the things that you're doing in your life. And it's like it just doesn't matter any longer. It's not as if you act that way. You act as if what you're doing matters, but deep inside of you, in that little special place where you know that you are thought and thought is you, and you are a higher consciousness and a higher awareness than all of this other stuff, you just sort of stand back and you get more productive, and you get less consumed with what other people are thinking. You get yourself totally out of controlling relationships, and you find yourself moving away from all of that kind of stuff that used to be such a very important part of your life, trying to get this one to like you and trying to please that one, or being in a relationship in which someone is in authority over you, controlling you. You leave that. That all goes, and you avoid confrontation and conflict because that isn't you any longer. And you're much more peaceful with the whole thing. And then after a while, you start looking for the beauty in everything that everybody else does, or the joy, or the serenity, or the ease, or the peace, whatever you want to call it. You start seeing that in everyone that you run into. And so someone will cut you off on the freeway, or somebody will yell at you, or somebody will be obnoxious towards you, or someone will not pay their debt towards you, or any number of things that at one time would have driven you absolutely insane. You look at them and you see, but that's where they are on their path. Try to think of yourself in terms of energy. Everything in the universe is energy. Your body, the bones, the blood, the gristle, the hair, the skull, all of the things that constitute your body are really a form of energy. They're just resonating at a certain frequency, and they appear to be solid because of the frequency that we look at them.
Well, the energy that I'm talking about is not the energy that resonates at the solid form, but another kind of energy that is also with you at all times. And this is like having an energy body, if you will, that is physical, and also an energy body that is spiritual. And the primary energy that you've been using all your life is what we call this outer energy, or this physical energy. This is what we call the life-sustaining energy of the physical body that allows the heart to beat and the lungs to fill up and the blood to circulate and the process of elimination and all of that. That's like an outer energy. There's also an inner energy. One of my great teachers in my life is a man named Swami Muktananda, who died a few years ago. And in one of his books that was published not too many years ago called Mystery of the Mind, he has this quotation. Listen to these words. He's talking about divine energy, which is the energy I'm asking you to consider. And he says, one day this light will explode, and you will see it everywhere. You will see the entire universe existing within it. The divine light of consciousness will begin to fill your eyes, and then wherever you look, you will see it. You will see its radiance in people, in trees, in rocks, and in buildings. You will see the same consciousness rising and falling in every wave of thought and feeling that passes through your mind. Wherever your mind goes, you will find your own inner consciousness, the creator of the world. You will see that the entire universe is contained within your own self. You will know that everything, all the infinite modifications of the world, is nothing but your own play. You will realize that it is you who are being reflected everywhere, and that it is your own reflection that passes before you all the time. And I'd like to add to that that you have within yourself this power of transcendence over the ego-dominated life. You can turn around and face inward, directly contacting your spiritual nature. You can then live each of your days, regardless of what you may be doing, with the sense of bliss that comes from being on the path of your sacred quest. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what your form is like. Whether you have decided along the way and all the decisions you've made since you've been here to be a housewife or to be a businessman or to be an accountant or to be a dentist or a cab driver or a pizza delivery man, none of that really matters. I'm not talking about what you do here. I'm really talking about the inner divine energy that you possess. Perhaps you can understand it best through a metaphor. Many, many times I've watched the old stagecoach movies with John Wayne. And every single one of these old westerns that I used to go to when I was a little boy and going to the Roy Rogers Riders Club and paying my 12 cents on a Saturday afternoon to be entertained, there would be a scene in the movie. And this scene I'm sure that you have seen before many, many times if you've ever watched an old western. And it's a scene where there's a whole bunch of horses, and they have the reins attached to this coach, and the coach has a driver, and perhaps the driver has been shot or wounded, and the horses are out of control, just running along. The driver is no longer in control of the coach, and the coach is just being dragged helter-skelter through the sagebrush without any driver and without any purpose, it seems like. So here's the metaphor. It comes from the wonderful writings of one of my favorite people, Eknath Eswaran, in his beautiful book, The Dialogue with Death, which is an interpretation of one of the great Indian stories called the Katha Upanishad. The stagecoach is your body. The driver is your intellect. The horses that are out of control are your senses. There are five of them, and you know what they are. There's sight and sound and touch and taste and feeling. These are the horses, the senses, okay? Now, the horses are pulling the stagecoach along, all right? And this is a good metaphor for what happens to most of us in our lives. Our five senses, the things that give us pleasure in our lives, the physical sensations that we experience, the sensation of touch and taste and feel, the sexual things, the drug things, the eating things, all of these kinds of things are our senses. And they're pulling us along and pulling our body wherever we want it to go. Now, the driver, the intellect, has been wounded, is no longer in control. And the reins between the horse and the coach are the emotions that we have. And inside of the coach, in every one of these movies, there's a little lady from Philadelphia with a hat on who is pleading, pleading with the intellect and pleading with the horses to please just listen to me. I have a very lovely message to tell you. Don't allow yourself to be pulled in this direction. Please stop. Please listen to me. So the little lady from Philadelphia is your higher self. This is the spiritual part of you. There's a sense in your tongue that is called your taste bud that weighs less than an ounce. And I have seen that taste bud that weighs less than 1 ounce pulling a 280-pound man into a bakery. And the bakery is there, and here he's looking at these cream puffs, and the little lady from Philadelphia is in there saying, don't eat this stuff, you know, eat some raw vegetables and take good care of yourself, and this is going to kill you. And you've just lost control. You have no intellect, and the emotions are just running wild, but your senses are directing your life. And the little lady from Philadelphia is inside there, and she's saying, don't go into that bar, and don't drink that alcohol, and don't use all of those substances that are going to destroy you. And here come the horses, and they're pulling you right into the bar, and you go right up to the bar. And these senses, these horses that are out of control, are running your life. Your body is being pulled in that direction, and the little lady from Philadelphia, which represents your higher self, doesn't get paid any attention. And what do you say? I have an alcohol problem. But you don't have an alcohol problem. Your horses have an alcohol problem, and you have a horse problem. And your horse problem is that you don't have them under control. You are allowing these senses and this external energy to pull you through life and to dictate what it is that you should be doing in almost every aspect of your life. You allow these ego-dominated senses, these temporary amounts of little bit of pleasure, which are just nothing more than counterfeit freedoms that you get for just a split second, and then they're gone, and then you're chasing after it some more. And the horses are pulling this body and pulling your mind through your life, and you never listen to that sweet little beautiful voice inside the coach that is saying, you know, get your life under control. There's something much grander and much greater than this. Let's get a hold of these reins, and let's train these horses to go in the direction that we want them to go, rather than allowing them to pull us uncontrollably. I don't know if you've ever noticed in your life, but when you are inspired in your life, when you're truly inspired in your life, everything seems to be working. For me, when I am inspired, it is with my writing and my speaking. When you are inspired, very often you are making love to the person that you adore. When you are inspired, very often you might be painting, you might be creating music, you might be cooking up something that you've never cooked up before, you might be in a dream, you might be listening to music. Whatever it is, when you feel inspired, you're not thinking about what's missing, you're not thinking about whether or not you have enough money to do what you want to do. The money seems to take care of itself. You don't think about any of your ills, any of your pains, any of your struggles. That's all for the moment of your inspiration, those things are all gone from your life. And why is that so? Why does the moment of your inspiration seem to be devoid of all of the ego-centered kinds of things about your self-absorption and your fears and your doubts and you're not having enough money and you got pains and you got all of these things? Why is that? Because the word inspire really comes from the concept of inspiration. To be inspired means to be in spirit. I remember the story of Sir Laurence Olivier, who had given one of the greatest performances of Hamlet that had ever been given in history, someplace in, I think it was at Oxford in England. And they had given him a 20-minute standing ovation, and it was this rousing thing. And he went back to his dressing room, and one of his friends came into the room and said, "That was fabulous. There's never been an interpretation of Hamlet like that." And Sir Laurence Olivier said, "Don't you think I know that?" And he was very upset. And his friend said, "How could you possibly be upset after that, giving that great performance?" And his response was, "But I don't know how I did it and if I can ever do it again." And that's almost the inner kind of energy that drives us. When we get inspired, we know there's something else working. We know something else is there with us, supporting us, guiding us, helping us. Somehow we know we're not doing this thing alone. I wrote a book a few years ago called Your Sacred Self. And in the sacred self, I talk about the two parts of us, if you will. There's one part of us that is an idea, and we call it the ego. And this idea is that who I am is separate, and who I am is special, and who I am is important. And the key word is separate, who I am is separate from others. In other words, where I begin and where you stop is what separates us, so that you and I are not the same according to this ego, because you're in a different body than I am, and you stop there, and there's your boundaries, and here are my boundaries here, and we've come to believe in this sort of separateness part of us. But then there's another part of us, an idea also, that says, I don't care about separation. I am in a different world. I don't have any boundaries. That's this part of me that is looking out, if you will. And this part I call the sacred self, or the highest self. And this part of us only wants one thing. It doesn't care whether we're right, which is the ego is very concerned about that. It doesn't care whether we're better than, doesn't care what we look like. It doesn't care about any of the physical characteristics that we have come to identify as ourself. This higher part of ourself only wants one thing, and that thing that it wants is for us to be at peace. So that whenever you're questioning whether or not it's your higher self or your sacred part of you or the ego part of you that is motivating me at any particular moment, the question to ask yourself is this going to bring me peace? And if the answer to that is yes, it's going to bring me peace, then you listen to that higher part of you. If the answer to that is no, it's going to bring me turmoil, it's going to create problems for me, I'm going to end up in an argument, I'm not going to be happy if I do this, whatever, I'm not going to be healthy if I do this, this isn't going to work for me, then it's the ego, the part of us that believes that we are separate from. Now, this key word in knowing and living from the highest self is separation. That's the key word, separation. That somehow we have come to really endorse this idea that I am separate from God, that I am separate from my fellow man, and that I am separate from my environment, and that overcoming this and living from a different perspective, one of the things that I have worked and worked and worked on in my own life, and I still continue to work on it every day, and in my own relationship with my wife and with my children particularly, is this idea of allowing this higher part of myself that just wants me to be at peace, just wants peace and nothing else, to play more of a dominant role, to tame this part of me that is so concerned with my self-importance and with being right and with proving somebody else to be wrong and with being offended and all of the stuff, the turmoil that we live with and create because of this reliance on this ego. So knowing that we have a higher self or a highest self really means detaching ourselves from a lot of the things that we have come to believe is who we are. Now, the beliefs that we have, that we've grown up with, that we've practiced all of our daily rituals on, is what I call the tribe thinking, the thinking of the tribe. You see, all of us are members of a tribe. And that tribe might be your immediate family. It might be the ethnic group to which you belong. It might be the people who share the same color of skin that you happen to have. It may be people who have the same philosophical points of view or political points of view or religious points of view or people who are related to you genetically in some way, cousins and aunts and uncles and so on. Anyway, there's this tribe that we sort of are born into, if you will. And the tribe evolves at a certain speed, so that as a tribe, as a people, we have evolved from hunters and gatherers, if you will, to people who now have computer chips and people who can just go in and have our meat and our vegetables just arranged for us in cellophane, in packaging, in department stores. There's been an evolution. The tribe has evolved so that most places on the planet people can get fresh drinking water by just turning a knob. There was a time when they had to dig holes, right, and try to find it. So the evolution of the tribe is in place, but it moves very slowly. It takes a long, long, long time for the tribe to evolve. What I'm talking about here, when you come to know your highest self and to live by it, is leaving the tribe and leaving tribal consciousness. You see, to be an individual, when you go to the tribe and you tell them, I've discovered something that's about manifesting, you know, and I'm going to really practice this, and I'm going to do this, and I know I can do this. Jesus said we can do this. Sai Baba told us we can do this. You know, Muktananda tells us we can do this. I'm going to do this. The tribe immediately goes, wait a second here. What are you doing? We don't want any individuals in this tribe. The purpose of the tribe is to keep individual people from surfacing. It's to keep it down. It's to have, if what I'm saying to you is that if you're going to learn manifesting and you're going to understand your highest self, you have to somehow figure out a way to let go of this idea that the tribe is going to give me approval or that I'm going to do it within the parameters that the tribe has dictated. Because what you're doing when you're learning to manifest, or when you're learning anything that is outside of the restricted parameters of the tribe, what you are doing is you are speeding up the evolution of your awareness and your consciousness. You are saying, I am going to evolve at a faster rate. But if you go to the tribe and tell them that, immediately you're going to get put into your place. You see, the mantra of the tribe is, but what will they think? That's the mantra of the tribe. What are they going to think of me? And the minute that you start playing that game of what are they going to think, you have stopped yourself from being able to evolve at a faster rate of speed. So leaving the tribe and the tribal consciousness is really what you're saying is, if I'm going to evolve at the speed at which the tribe is evolving, you're saying, I'm going to evolve, but I'm going to do it very, very slowly. And if you want to manifest, if you want to really become a manifester in your life, you don't have enough time in this lifetime. You've got to come back in 19 lifetimes. Right? You don't have enough time for that. So it's almost like getting out of that consciousness.
One helpful way that I have of thinking of the higher self and the ego is to think of a body and a shadow. The body that you have when you go out into the light casts a shadow. The shadow, of course, is just illusory. It's not real. You can't get a hold of it. It's an illusion. The higher self is the real self. The ego is the shadow. That which is never changing, that which was never born, that which is eternal, is the part of you that is actually processing this right now, the part of you that is thinking, that invisible part of you. And all of the thoughts that you have cast this shadow called your body. There is no security in a shadow. It's wonderful to know your real self, because when you know the real self, then you don't live with the shadow that is always sort of an illusion and is always changing. You look at this body of yours and you see it changing all the time. You know that when you were born, that your birth came with a letter that introduces you to your own death, and that every little gray hair that you see is just a little postcard reminding you of that, and every wrinkle that shows up, and that we all face it. It is something that you will experience. It came with your birth certificate. And it's like having that knowing that this body is not where you do your primary identification. That's what the ego wants you to believe, because the most embarrassing event in the world for the ego is death. And of course, you are not this body. You are that which is observing it. And that is eternal. And that's the real self. Another great way of saying this is from the Bhagavad Gita. It says in the Gita, you were never born. How can you die? You have never suffered change. How can you be changed? Unborn, eternal, immutable, immemorial. You do not die when the body dies. That's a freeing thought. What a freeing notion to know that you can never die when you begin to identify with the part of you that is changeless and eternal, rather than the body identification which the ego promotes so strongly. The ego is cowardly. I love this quote from Ken Wapnick in a Course in Miracles workshop that he gave one time. He said, "The ego is nothing more than a belief, and it is a belief in the reality of separation. The ego is the false self that seemingly came into being when we separated ourselves from God. Therefore, as long as we believe that the separation is real, the ego is in business. Once we believe that there is no separation, then the ego is finished." And cowardliness is a characteristic of the ego because the ego will do everything in its power to keep you believing in your separation from everyone else. The ego operates on fear and cowardice. The ego is frightened to death of your coming to grips with your higher part of yourself. And it will do everything that it can to keep you from facing directly inward and knowing that higher power within you. It is afraid, afraid, afraid of you knowing this higher part of yourself, because that light, that celestial light that is within you, that inner knowing of bliss and peace, is the thing that will blind it and make it no longer necessary in your life. Your ego is not that thing between your id and your superego that Freud talked about. No. Your ego is not yourself. It is your idea of yourself, and therefore it is false. Your ego is your false self. It is not real. It is an illusion. It is something that you have come to believe in. Swami Muktananda had a wonderful line. He said, "Enlightenment is your ego's greatest disappointment." When you understand that you are not separate, you do not have to be better than. You do not have to have more than. You are not more special than. You are that which is eternal and changeless. That which offends you is you telling yourself that you are better than those people who are doing the offending. And it puts you in a position of believing that God is doing work outside of you that you have to somehow correct. When you know that you are the source, that God is within you, and that you no longer have to have this vision of yourself as something that has to prove itself. I'm not saying to conquer the ego. There's no fighting here. This is not a war. You have to understand what you are not. You are not your body. You are not your name. You are not your occupation. You are not any of those things which you have come to identify as who you are. You are that which is eternal and changeless, trapped in this garage where you park your soul for just an instant in eternity. Just an instant. And when you know that, you have the keys to higher awareness, and you have an appreciation of this piece of divine wisdom. When you come to believe in yourself, when you come to know yourself, not the idea of yourself. When you come to know yourself and trust in that self, what you're really learning to do is to trust in the very wisdom that created you. Your ego keeps you distracted from your deep driving desire in life. It keeps you on little desires, like the coffee that you have to have in the morning before you can get going, or the sweets that you have to have before you go to bed at night, or all of the little kinds of distractions that go on a daily basis in your life that you put so much energy into. Whether things are on time, whether the deadline is being met, whether people are dressing the way they're supposed to be dressing. You know, all of these kinds of little distractions that you put a big part of your energy and your life into, you begin to abandon those and let them go, and you begin to discover that there's a deeper, more significant, a richer, more powerful, deep drive that is at the core of your being. It's like the reason for being here. The ego part of you is saying to you over and over again, if things don't work out the way you want to, if this strong desire that you have is something that you can't have right now, then other people are taking advantage of you, and you're not really as important, and you're not powerful anymore, and you're not as significant, and you're not as special. So it's very important in this whole idea of transcending the lower self and not allowing our lower identities to constantly control our lives. It's much more important for you to be less self-absorbed. And the less self-absorbed you are, the more freedom you have, whether it's an absence in your physical body with all of the kinds of migraines and all of the kinds of allergies that people have and all of the different cardiovascular problems that we have and the ulcerative colitis that people show up with and just the inner kind of anxiety that we live with. All of that is a reduction of freedom in the physical world, and you're also not free in the metaphysical world, that is beyond the physical. Your freedom is taken away from you with everything that has to be a certain way. And the ego promotes that, and the higher self is unattached to it. One of the things that you don't want being said about yourself is that my life is at the mercy of anyone who chooses to annoy me. So that if you can get to a point where whatever it is that shows up in your life is just being able to be processed by the higher part of yourself, which isn't attached to you being right and them being wrong and you having to have certain needs met, then you're no longer at the mercy of that. I think one of the most common questions I get when I talk about this subject of freedom through higher awareness is, how do I know? How do I know if it's my ego talking or if it's my higher self talking? Well, the first answer to that question is that if it brings you peace, it is your higher self beckoning you. If it brings you turmoil, it is your ego beckoning you. So this is the first conflict that we can learn to resolve between the ego and the higher self. Remember, your ego wants to survive. If it can keep you in a state of inner turmoil, it's going to block you from knowing your spiritual self. From your ego's perspective, God is a threat. So, it's going to do all that it can to keep you from experiencing that inner peacefulness where God's voice is so beautifully clear. You want peace. Every person on this planet wants to feel a sense of peace, of harmony, of joy, of fulfillment. If you begin to understand how your ego works and why, you can begin to see that it's going to do all that it can to keep you from enjoying that sense of peace. It's going to convince you that meditation is absurd, that being silent is crazy and it's a waste of time, that this is a world of conflict. This isn't a world where people can live together in peace. Look at the whole history of the world. Your ego constantly whispers in your ear, there's other people out there who are going to try to defeat you if you don't get stronger than they are. You've got to arm yourself. You've got to protect yourself. You've got to stay in this constant state of alertness. And there's a lot of dangers out there. This is a very dangerous and tumultuous world, says the ego. Your higher self says this is a safe place, that you're not this body. You are something else. You are something that is eternal. You can witness all of this. You don't have to be filled with all of this anxiety and stress. So there's this conflict that's going all the time. And the typical peace avoidance behaviors that most of us exhibit in our lives include things like confronting and arguing. Nothing brings about an inner feeling of turmoil faster than allowing yourself to be seduced into fighting or arguing. And the ego is pushing you to do just that, to keep that turmoil alive and moving in your life. So make that other person wrong. You are right. You are special. You are unique. They have no right to talk to you like that. And so you find yourself being ego-driven and self-absorbed. The moment that you can let go of that, you begin listening to your higher self. Another kind of behavior that shows up over and over again is competing and comparing yourself. When you compare yourself to others as a measurement of your performance or feelings of success, you're at the mercy of your false self. You've bought into the erroneous idea that God plays favorites and that you will in some way be better when you are ahead of someone else. Ego is talking to you in a style that you've probably been taught to believe is important to your success in life. Ego tells you, if he can, so can you. You are much smarter, much prettier, much stronger, much more spiritual, more stable. You see, You have to assert your superiority and show them the truth. You are the best. Now get out there and prove it to everyone. You must purchase something they can't afford to demonstrate how successful you are. This is the ego promoting this kind of turmoil, which keeps you off balance, which doesn't allow you to just enjoy your life. Your higher self is saying over and over again, you don't have to do that. It's the little lady from Philadelphia in the coach who's whispering to you. You don't have to beat anybody else down to prove yourself. You are divine, just the way you are. Let go, relax, find your purpose. Let go of all of these ideas of other people being threats to you. It's not a threatening world. It's a peaceful world. Inside of you is not a sinner. Inside of you is a saint, is someone that is peaceful and beautiful and loving. Your ego promotes you chasing and striving after things. Every movie you go to anymore has a chase scene in it because somebody has to be finding something else out and going after more and chasing somebody else down. All this turmoil. Worrying is another form that this turmoil takes in your life. Finding all the things that you have to be concerned about and keeping your ego constantly telling you, well, you don't know what might happen to your children and you better get yourself armed and protected and who knows what could happen and the ozone layer is opening up and the world is falling apart and there's going to be a hurricane and there's going to be another earthquake and it's endless kinds of worry, worry, worry about everything you can. The ego loves to keep you at that state of inner turmoil because when you are at turmoil, the ego is in charge. When you're at peace, God is in charge, and the ego fears God. The ego says constantly, don't you realize how special you are? You're not like everyone else. You got to get people to notice you and approve of you. If they don't notice you, there's something wrong with you. So you go out and you spend your life in trying to be noticed through these purchases and through all of this bragging and all of this kind of ego-dominated self-absorption, which puts the focus on you. And as you do that, you lose sight of this higher part of yourself. And the higher part of yourself is what the ego fears. Therefore, the ego will keep you doing things that say, notice me, notice me. It will put deadlines on you. It will put pressures on you. It'll convince you over and over again that you can't ever take time to relax. Because if you do, somebody else is going to get ahead of you. That's the ego. That's the ego talking. The higher self is saying something else. I want peace. I am peaceful. I am blissful.